Si no os estáis quietos, no os retrato. Y cuando yo diga alto, que nadie se mueva.
Presidente Bill Clinton.
Welcome to Fearful Symmetry.
Go around. I told you about a 1990s television series called Hatchet Man, a show that depicted the dreams and struggles of simple everyday people in the fine but underprivileged land of Albania. And at the end of each and every episode in the series, a figure in a balaclava, a ski mask, would enter the scene with a swinging hatchet and brutally slaughter all the nice innocent people that we met in the previous hour. Classic family entertainment. I learned that this notorious TV show had long been attributed to the celebrated Albanian director Saimir Kambaro. But was that right? Did he actually conceive the whole thing? For there were rumors that the true and secret author of the show was a weird reclusive woman of the woods, none other than Kambaro's wife, Rovena. So who was this Rovena? Oh, let me put on my Rovena theme music. There you go. Her full name is Rovena Marjeta Markaj. Her parents were simple, pious folk who worked as custodians and moth keepers in a small provincial rubber mat factory. She had no siblings, no real friends, and spent most of her time in solitary pursuits building elaborate dioramas out of twigs and shrubbery. She was said to possess a certain beauty, but a countenance so strange and habits so peculiar that people felt uneasy around her. As an adolescent, Rovena was often glimpsed in the woods moving as a woodland animal, here prancing like a fawn, there burrowing like a mole, face covered in mud, mouth full of worms. As you might imagine, this all troubled her parents. They went to the local imam and he recommended a nearby asylum where she might receive tender care, away from the judging eyes of their neighbors. And so Rovena entered this sanctuary. I've actually seen the records from the institution. They document her arrival and detail her curious habit of conversing with all the trees on the grounds of the asylum, apparently a different tree each day. But after a few months, the record stops, nothing more, as if the later files were expunged, God knows why, and it would be years before she resurfaces again. And at that point, most of what we do know about Rovena comes from Saimir Kambaro's autobiography, Reflections from the Left Eyeball of the Eagle, which I've also seen translated, just as awkwardly, as Facing the Right Eye of the Eagle's Secret Mirror. And there, on page 72 of his memoir, the famed filmmaker describes, in mythic fashion, his first fateful encounter with Rovena Markaj. He writes that he was foraging for mushrooms deep in a forest straddling the Macedonian border, when he suddenly felt an electrical charge coursing through his flesh and began to hear a certain ringing in his ears. The ringing soon fell away to reveal a strange luminous voice, as if some angel in the woods were singing to him. He stumbles ahead following the sound and starts to make out the words. He soon realizes that he knows this song, or rather, the story of the song. This angel is singing all the scenes from Louis Buñuel's 1961 movie, Verdiana, which basically happens to be Kambaro's favorite film in the world. In fact, the Spanish filmmaker Buñuel had been the inspiration for Kambaro's entire career. But to hear his favorite film sung? In the woods? He said he wondered, is this some kind of delirium? Am I losing my mind? But then he sees her. He sees Rowena, and he writes,
"She stood in a beam of light beside an ancient oak, a snow-white raven poised upon her left shoulder, and gazed at me with the wide, unblinking eyes of a gazelle. The forest trembled, and I knew that this angel held my destiny."
Okay, apologies for my terrible impersonation of Kimbero's voice, but that is his account of meeting Rowena Merheta Merkaj. Kimbero's book is full of crazy shit like this. All we know for sure is that at some point, the two did marry, and they settled down in a cottage by the edge of those very same woods in which they first met. They lived reclusively. She avoided the nearby town, and he, devoted to her, enraptured, really, wanted little more than to be by her side. As he would later write,
"I have found my angel. I have found my great muse."
And in some ways, that was probably pretty true, because Rowena definitely came to play a critical role in all of his writings. That script of Kimbero's for his acclaimed Death of the Groundhog, it turns out it lay unfinished for years until Rowena showed up. She was the one who honed it to creative fruition. Kimbero soon learned that it was wise to heed everything she said, for somehow her grasp of cinema was breathtaking. She was a savant and could recite shot by shot the order of any film she ever saw, even just once. Often, in the middle of the night, she would wake him to softly expound on the arcane designs of auteurs, from Cassavetes to Jodorowsky. She could simply be making white bean and radish soup or knitting a scarf when she would suddenly launch into a dreamlike history of Iranian film. At one point, early on in their union, Kimbero asked his wife where in the world she learned so much about cinema. That was a mistake. A queer, disapproving expression crossed her face. She said nothing and turned to gaze out the window. Suddenly, Kimbero writes, a swarm of blood-red butterflies adorned with tiny black diamonds rose up out of nowhere, fluttering only a foot or two from her as if dancing for her pleasure. They both watched in silence, and when the creatures flew off in a kaleidoscopic stream, Rowena turned toward him, looked directly into his eyes, and told him that she had no interest in the past. "If you ever ask me that again," she said, "I will leave forever." Kimbero wrote that he never said another word about it. He loved her. The maestro may have been brusque, imperial, and diminishing with others, but with Rowena, the poor fool lived in tender adoration. He couldn't help himself. Indeed, he frequently felt compelled, tragically compelled, to stand before her, pound his fist against his heart, and announce, "You are my angel." Rowena would take a weary breath as if to say, "This again, Saimir." And he would go on, "I am devoted to your every breath." At which point she would slap his face hard. This stuff is all in his book. Presumably, it was the only way to shut him up. But Kimbero wrote that sometimes, on a good and favorable day, his angel would follow the slap with a smile, and the heavens themselves would open up. And so, in this way, they got along. By late morning, when he was at his desk working on some screenplay, Rowena would wander off, presumably into the woods. She never spoke about what she did there, and he knew better than to ask. She would return home at day's end with herbs, bark, feathers, small vials of liquid, or sometimes books related to the study of bird song or the auditory behavior of crickets. He would simply bid her welcome, hand her a glass of wine, set up the chessboard, perhaps rub her feet. And then, at some point in the evening, Kimbero would gather up his projector and a few film reels, and the two of them would walk the 37 paces from the cottage to a beloved chestnut tree. There, Rowena would hang a white sheet, and under the stars, they would screen the evening's film. Their favorite was a battered 16mm print of Masaki Kobayashi's Kwaidan, a series of ghost stories, including one in which the long, black, glossy hair of an abandoned wife magically pursues her haunted husband. And as they watched, Rowena's hand would always hold his. Cambero said it was a charmed time, one that he never wanted to end. But it would end. It did end. And the end began somehow with snails. The snails were calling. One morning, in bed, Rowena says to Cambero that she must go, that the snails were calling her. Cambero didn't know what to make of that. What snails? Go where? This is fucking absurd. But he only nodded in consent with but the slightest suggestion of irritation. For by now, as I've already noted, around Rowena, the maestro had become a good and obedient dog. And so that very morning, she took off on her journey. It was only later that Cambero discovered that she had hiked to a place he knew very well, a place all Albanians and Macedonians know, the ancient and the fabled Lake Ohrid. Now, this is one incredible lake. It formed more than a million years ago. Its waters are exquisitely clear and pure. The lake runs 1,000 feet down, and its aquatic ecosystem is an underworld of living fossils. Diving down into Lake Ohrid is said to be diving into the past, into life beyond memory. And there, deep, deep down under the rocks, lives a certain breed of snail called Gochea ohridana. Nowhere else on Earth can you find this tiny species, only in Lake Ohrid. And there's an ancient myth surrounding these snails. It's said that long ago, the snails came out of the sky from another world to this one, that they conjure messages that only God knows how to read, but of which the angels whisper, and that one day they will emerge out of the depths and sing their secret stories to humankind so that all will understand. And Rowena, on a hot summer day when she was a little girl, her family visited Lake Ohrid, and that's when she first heard the voices of the snails. And she has periodically returned to that lake ever since. And it's said that she knows the stories. And when Rowena returned home to Semir Cambaro after her long trip to Lake Ohrid, she readied the tea, took off her clothes, beckoned Cambaro come close, and gave him a deep, sensual kiss. And then she whispered softly into his ear, "We're going to make a TV series." At this point, I should tell you about how I first stumbled upon this Hatchet Man universe. It was some 15 years ago. I was doing some freelance reporting in Eastern Europe and found myself in Pristina, Kosovo, at the unveiling of an 11-foot statue of Bill Clinton. I've always been a sucker for bizarre monuments, so I was pretty stoked. The former American president was seen as a kind of savior over there for bombing the Serbs in 1999 when they were more or less trying to wipe out the region's ethnic Albanians. So years later, when they erected his statue, located on a major avenue renamed Bill Clinton Boulevard, no less, Clinton himself showed up looking quite jolly. The day was freezing, but thousands were there cheering as Clinton gave his speech and then proceeded to shake every hand in the city. It was that very evening that I was having cocktails with my driver, Arion, a most engaging man who said, if I thought the Clinton statue was weird, and I did, that I've got to get over to Tirana to see the Hatchet Man monument. I was like, what? What's a Hatchet Man monument? And that's when he first told me about this old Albanian TV show that always ended in the characters getting completely massacred. I thought, okay, this is total bullshit. I mean, does he imagine that every American is a gullible chump after a few drinks? But when he sees I'm not buying it, Arion jumps up makes a couple of calls, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting in the small, cramped apartment of some mailman, a friend of a friend of Arion's sister-in-law, who has a bunch of bootleg VHS tapes of Hatchet Man. And that's how I watched my very first episodes of the series. Now, this mailman had a big shepherd dog, Marusha, that took to me immediately, sitting next to me on the floor and sometimes resting her head on my lap and looking at me with what I can only call love eyes. My host commanded the pup not to bother me, but I assured him I was fine. Truth was, it was the most affection I had felt in months, and I was extremely grateful for the dog's touch. So, in tribute to Marusha, let me tell you about the very first Hatchet Man episode that I happened to see that night, because it features a very good dog. Really, it's a story of a good dog and a good man. The man's name was Ergy, and Ergy lived in an old mushroom-shaped concrete bunker. Now, this may sound strange to you, living in a bunker, but in Albania, not so strange. Albania's twisted 20th century history of political paranoia, we'll get to that eventually, led to the construction of hundreds of thousands of bunkers that still dot the coastline, the fields, the villages, everywhere. Each bunker was installed to defend the homeland from foreign powers that were presumably forever scheming to invade one of the most impoverished nations on Earth. And over the years, there were Albanians who just decided to use some of these old bunkers as homes. That's what Ergy did in this episode. He was an old-timer and still held a job that the state designated decades before as a sentry. Albanians considered these outdated positions a kind of a joke. In this case, it basically meant that Ergy still had his old, state-issued, ridiculous-looking rifle, and that every day he would take out his binoculars and scan the Adriatic Sea for invaders. The job paid a pittance, but he didn't need much. He had a transistor radio, a cot, a pipe. He never complained. He never said much at all. Ergy kept to himself, a real loner. There's a moment on the show when three men are speculating about what happened to Ergy's family. One said that they were sent off to a penal colony when he was a child. Another asserted that they were brutally slaughtered. The third disagreed and said, no, it was something really bad. An example of Albanian gallows humor where you were considered lucky if your family just got off with imprisonment and execution. Basically, no one knew anything about Ergy's past, and maybe it was the expression on his face, but he was often ridiculed as a simple-minded dolt, even though the show really presents him as just a quiet, misunderstood guy. So one day, Ergy is shuffling through the village, collecting scraps of metal that he might make use of, when he hears the low, pathetic moaning of an animal in distress. He spies a bunch of kids behind a shed, throwing rocks at a bleeding one-eyed dog so exhausted that it can hardly limp away. So Ergy lumbers over, yells at the kids, You go! The kids start laughing at him. For a moment, they consider throwing rocks at Ergy before they just scatter. Ergy then swoops up the dog. He was a big pooch, but in that emaciated condition, probably no more than 50 pounds, and he takes him home to his bunker. And how he was rewarded by that pup. Love, appreciation, companionship. The two became inseparable. Ergy would sing old folk songs, and Cyclops, that's what Ergy called the one-eyed dog, Cyclops would howl along with him. Ergy would scan the sea, and Cyclops would be his doggy reflection, pivoting his head in the same way. Ergy would smoke his pipe as the sun went down, and Cyclops would lovingly sit at his feet, looking up in contented appreciation, not unlike how the mailman's dog Marusha was looking at me as I was watching the show. For Ergy, he was Cyclops the Sweet. And how was Ergy regarded by his neighbors for saving the dog? Scorn, ridicule, keep that cur away, you damn fool, it would just bring disease and eat our food. But there was one person, Toshka, the village seamstress, who always treated Ergy and the dog with kindness. Toshka was a widow, raising five children on her own after her husband was struck dead by lightning during a heated game of bocce with a local mortician. I can't tell you if the dying while playing bocce with the mortician was supposed to be tragic or absurdly comic, but the show does go to the trouble of presenting the lightning strike in a dazzling slow-mo flashback. Anyhow, Toshka always treated the solitary Ergi tenderly, asking how he was doing, freely repairing his clothes, and whenever she heard any village gossip saying Ergi was a degenerate or an idiot or what have you, she would tell them to mind their business and leave the man alone. Now, one day, one of Toshka's sons goes missing. He was actually one of the same kids throwing rocks at Cyclops. No one knew what happened to the boy, just disappeared. Maybe he drowned in the river, ran away, foul play, nobody knew. And Toshka was just beside herself with grief. Days pass. And then one morning, Cyclops goes missing too. Ergi looks for the dog day and night, not a trace. He goes to the baker to see if he's seen Cyclops. No, and I hope I never see him again. He goes to the postal carrier. No, and good riddance to that flea-ridden mongrel. He goes to a farmer tending to his goats. No, and to hell with that devil beast. So now, Ergi, like Toshka before him, is utterly heartbroken. More days pass, and then one afternoon, Ergi hears shouts. Cyclops has returned. He's coming through the village pulling a big red wheelbarrow, and inside it, the missing boy. Apparently, the kid had broken his leg, he was trapped in some kind of ditch, and somehow the dog rescued him. Really, it never was clear how the dog got the kid out, let alone how he found a wheelbarrow. But hey, you don't quibble with sentimental Albanian television. The important thing is that Ergi and Toshka are overjoyed and incredibly relieved, and Cyclops suddenly becomes a big hero. And now the villagers love the dog. Everyone is scratching the pup's ears and giving him a treat or a little kiss, and they're all full of praise, saying, if there was ever a noble dog, that's him right there, and who would have thought that a dog could do God's work, that sort of thing. And then some people start singing this jaunty tune that's clearly something like, for he's a jolly good fellow. And Cyclops is happily barking, woof, woof, woof. And it's a terrific time for Ergi as much as Cyclops, because he's finally being accepted by everybody too. And you've got all these laughing, singing villagers together in front of Ergi's bunker, and it's just such a tender and lovely moment. And then we glimpse what seems to be the figure of a man in a balaclava in the shadow of a tree in the background. And suddenly there's a quick cut, and we see the man, who I now know is Hatchet Man, standing right next to Cyclops. And he reaches down and he just pets Cyclops. He's just taking his time, softly petting the dog, when shoo, a hatchet blade slices through Cyclops. The poor one-eyed dog has been cut in half, and there's a beat of stunned silence, and then pandemonium. Mad whirling hatchets, swinging blood-curdling cries. Ergi's arms have been cut off, and dying villagers are crawling on the ground, blood gushing out of their mouths, and there are body parts and gore everywhere. It's just a gruesome tableau of death. Until finally we see Hatchet Man just kind of skipping away into the sunset. And then the music begins, and the images of waterfalls and farms that I saw in the beginning, and this episode of Hatchet Man comes to a close. And I remember being a little dazed and giddy by this ending, and I just turned laughing to the mailman and told him, we gotta watch another one. But he had a somber, distant look on his face. I later learned he had lived in Albania during the 90s, during the time of the show, and his brother was one of those caught up in the hatchet cult and murdered in the street the night when the final episode of Hatchet Man was broadcast, a night of murder and revolt and catastrophe. But at the time, I didn't know any of that. I just saw the mailman sitting there, a million miles away, saying softly to himself, Niyemi Hatchet, Niyemi Hatchet, Niyemi Hatchet. We are the hatchet We are the hatchet. We are the hatchet.
You've been listening to part two of Hatchet Man, a production of Fearful Symmetry, written, performed, and produced by Bob Paris. Music and sound art from Voyagers, The Shed, Fabio Kiner, J.S. Bach, Kevin MacLeod, John Bartman, KSO Art, Turku, and Maidan. For more information, please go to fearfulsymmetry.org